With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, Brian German talks with USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney, who made a trip to California to talk about some USDA investments in the state. But first, our top story this morning, Canada's livestock industry says California's attempt to impose animal care orders on out-of-state farmers and out-of-country farmers are not allowed under the interstate or international trade regulations. However, there seems to be very little clarity on just what rules California is breaking. Dennis Guy reports.
California's Proposition 12 has been in force in that state since July. But beginning in the new year, pork importing distributors will need to submit third-party certification to California officials that their products are in compliance with that state's new regulations. Canada's farm animal care codes are part of its trade agreement with the U.S. Stephen Heckbert, the executive director of the Canadian Pork Council, says that under the USMCA deal, provinces and states are not permitted to create non-tariff trade barriers. But Heckbert says California has clearly done just that. And with the U.S. Supreme Court's favorable ruling, Stephen Heckbert says that livestock groups are in discussion with Ottawa over the issue.
It's a state proposition. Something like this has a direct impact. Important to remember, it actually impacts beef and chicken as well. Supreme Court may not have understood the kind of interstate commerce implications this will in fact have in terms of states being able to make, frankly, non-tariff trade barriers that will deal with international trade. International trade and international trade agreements are the sole provision of the U.S. government. We're working with our government here to see the impact of this Supreme Court decision.
The Canadian government has issued a statement saying that it is currently analyzing the issue and is considering the U.S. obligations under both the World Trade Organization and the existing USMCA. The Canadian Pork Council and other livestock groups say that the state of California's new rules are going to have international trade ramifications. However, Stephen Heckbert says that he is at a loss as to just how California is going to enforce their state rules on other American states or other countries come 2024 when the new codes are to be implemented.
Does California now have a nationwide auditing system where they will send inspectors to each of these barns, facilities? And if I'm in Iowa or I'm Nebraska, do I want inspectors from California? Whether the state of California now intends to send inspectors around Canada to determine who is Prop 12 compliant, I'm not really sure how California intends to do that. There's a whole bunch of implications.
Stephen Heckbert is the executive director of the Canadian Pork Council. Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor recently led a trade mission to Southeast Asia. California Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross was on the trip with her. The trip also included stops in Malaysia and Singapore. Taylor says it was a productive trip for everyone involved.
One of the things I wanted to highlight, I think, this morning is just the quality of meetings I know our business has had this week. We've had over 300 business-to-business meetings, but I think more impactful is the quality of those meetings, the interest of the buyers that I heard from our businesses on. In Southeast Asia, one of the reasons we focused trade mission here and or continue to focus some of our trade missions here is the population dynamics that we are seeing. They have a growing middle class.
She says demand remains strong for American commodities.
There is strong connection to the United States, a preference for U.S. food and agricultural products. There's a lot of trust in our quality, safety, reliability as a trading partner, which makes this a very attractive set of markets.
California Secretary of Agriculture Karen Ross was on that trip and says Southeast Asia is an important market for our state's farmers.
Southeast Asia is tremendously important for the California products that we like to export to this part of the country. It's about $2.5 billion last year. Dairy is the leading commodity that we're very proud of. And I've seen evidence of the California Milk Advisory Board all over the place, in addition to the U.S. Dairy Export Council, which has a fabulous innovation center that really shows their commitment to this market. And that's one of the things that we heard. Fresh fruit, especially citrus, grapes, and berries are products that we've seen on the shelves as well as tree nuts. And we had the Walnut Commission with us, which was very important for a commodity that's been struggling the last couple of years.
In other news, another ruling in the years-long battle over chlorpyrifos. A federal appeals court in St. Louis, Missouri, has struck down EPA's rule that effectively bans chlorpyrifos, a pesticide widely used in agriculture. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in a years-long battle involving environmental and agribusiness groups that the EPA failed to follow sound science and the law when it revoked chlorpyrifos tolerances in a 2021 rule. The American Farm Bureau Federation was among several farm groups that sued the EPA. AFB attorney Travis Cushman says the courts originally gave EPA 6 months to modify its tolerances rule.
And rather than modify them and just follow the science on it, they just kind of threw up their hands and canceled all tolerances. And the court found that was inappropriate without first looking at the science and the law.
EPA could still appeal the Eighth Circuit ruling, but AFB's Cushman is hoping otherwise.
But hopefully the EPA will realize it messed up. The court found it messed up. We've been telling them they messed up here and just agree to go ahead and allow these this product back in the market again.
Until then, Cushman says producers will continue being forced to use alternatives that may be less effective and cost more. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agricultural news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast app. We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm your host, Sabrina Halverson. In today's national spotlight, the 96th FFA National Convention and Expo happened last week in Indianapolis, with many companies looking for future employees. David Geiger has more.
Training and scouting the next generation in agriculture and technology is a big part of the FFA convention. And at a large booth this year, Rachel Blakenship with Lincoln Electric shows off lots of hands-on activities in welding.
I'm specifically working on our Cooper cobot. So this is our ABB cobot that we're using. It's really great for schools, really great for shops, bridges that gap between manual welding and robotic welding.
There's also extra safety features for students and trainees.
When the cobot's running into something, comes in contact with something, there are also, you would put up some sort of like light shield just to protect your welders or your operators, any passersby, from running into arc flash. So you don't have to have all of your safety features, all your guardrails, but you do have to have your light features. You want your PPE, things like that. And then as far as safety features, these things are built for heavy duty. So you don't have to have any sort of guarding on the arm. You don't have to have all of your safety features or a light vision area. So it's super great, super, super safe.
Blakenship says it also has an app.
So we have something called our Cooper app. The Cooper app really makes it super easy, super intuitive. You don't have to know anything about welding. So when you go into there, you're able to click weld and get going.
She adds this tool is also great for education.
So on the school side, it's great because they get that robotic experience as well as the welding experience. They can kind of see both sides of the manual and automatic. And then with the industry side, it's built for heavy duty. I mean, these things, I've seen people with rows of cobots all the way down their shop. And, you know, they can hire anybody who does not know anything about welding, get them in there, and they're able to get going pretty easily.
Blakenship says they even have a training trailer with VR programs.
So that's run by our AWS, and we partner with them. It's a whole virtual welding semi-truck that we have right here. They really try to get hands-on with the students and get experience running our different equipment.
While this is a chance to represent what they have to offer, Blakenship says it's also an opportunity to show off the industry as a whole.
Super great to get into the welding world. We want to make sure that we introduce students to the trades. They're able to see, okay, you know, maybe welding doesn't have to be as dirty as you want it to be, or it doesn't have to be as complicated as you want it to be. It's super easy, super intuitive and fun. So we want to make sure that we're giving that message to students that, you know, here we are, Lincoln Electric. We want to provide you with the training and the education, the resources to help bring that to your shops or to your schools.
From the 96th FFA convention in Indianapolis, I'm David Geiger.
That's today's National Spotlight. We head now over to Randall Wiseman with today's livestock report.
Well, in today's livestock news, Mexico's demand for U.S. red meat has been outstanding this year, with U.S. pork exports on a record pace and demand for U.S. beef reaching its highest level in several years. As John Harith reports, the U.S. Meat Export Federation has been working to showcase the value and versatility of both U.S. pork and beef.
Both beef and pork exports to Mexico are up sharply in 2023, with pork on a record pace up 14% over last year on volume. Beef shipments are up 17% on volume and 25% on value. U.S. Meat Export Federation's director in Mexico and Central America, Gerardo Rodriguez, says they have been working to broaden the cuts available to keep both beef and pork at the center of the plate.
We're using the chuck for those kind of restaurants that they usually use when work on the loins, which they are price sensitive. But what we want to keep it is the U.S. beef, in this case, to be the center of the plate and not the price to be the driver of the decision. We want you to understand that the product that you are getting from the U.S. has consistency and it has quality.
USMEF has been taking semi-trucks with mobile kitchens across the country to introduce decision makers and influencers to new cuts and recipes.
We have been working with over 800 decision makers around the country in order to work with them and introduce these new options that they can use in their gastronomy through the pork truck or through the U.S. beef truck that we have. So having these kind of people, decision makers, and they can stream the information going downstream in their establishment, in the restaurants, in their hotels, is very important for us. So the more knowledgeable, the more information we can provide them, and the more engaged that we can make them, is the easier for us. And this is not a matter of just a price. Once you understand the quality, once you understand the consistency and the benefit for your company and your restaurant and your point of sale about a good product that you're buying from the U.S., price is not going to be the main driver.
U.S. pork and beef promotions in Mexico are made possible through support from USDA, the National Pork Board, and the Beef Checkoff Program. For more, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. And the Beef Checkoff-funded Trailblazers program is seeking applications for its next class of beef advocates. Trailblazers, developed by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, takes advocacy to the next level by giving participants the tools and training they need to promote beef to new audiences while addressing and correcting any myths. The Trailblazers program is looking for a new spokespeople to participate in a year-long hands-on program that's designed to train, equip, and empower beef advocates. Selected candidates will receive training to become expert communicators, excel in media interviews, and understand how to build confidence in beef-related practices when talking to consumers. To learn more about the program, go to ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news and farm features when we return. Coming up in a few moments, we have today's This Land of Ours reports, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Ag businesses are looking at another cost of production increase. President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, said water fees have gone up across the board.
Whether you've got a confined animal feeding operation or you're a farmer, so you're in the irrigated lands program, or dramatically for us, the waste discharge requirements. So any of those guys that discharge water onto land from processing saw another 8.5% increase. And so considering we've seen 65 to 75% increase over the last 5 years, now you're adding another 8.5%, and there's no change in the requirements. It's just every year there's an increase. Given the fact of how much we've seen labor go up, how much we've seen electricity go up, how much we've seen fuel go up, every single cost has gone up, and now you're adding water fees going up 8.5%. I mean, that's more than the cost of living, more than the consumer price index, and there's no justification. And what are we getting for it? You know, the one thing we got out of them was to admit at least 40% of this cost is not even our cost. It has nothing to do with the waste discharge. It's statewide programs that used to be funded out of the general fund now are on our backs. We're the people they collect from. And, you know, they just fail to understand we have nobody to pass this cost on to. And so, you know, in a sense, every increase they do just kills more jobs. They're taking away jobs from the very people they claim they're representing and helping.
This year's Organic Grower Summit is set to have some additional features and networking opportunities for attendees. Coming up November 29th and 30th at the Hyatt Regency Monterey Hotel and Spa, the event is hosted by Organic Produce Network and Western Growers. Event manager for OGS, Keegan Ruse, said there are some new elements added to this year's agenda.
We have a lot of networking opportunities built into the schedule. One that we're really excited about this year that we've kind of revamped is our opening reception, making that more of a picnic slash tailgate, more of like a networking fun event compared to your traditional opening receptions. We will also be expanding our ag tech and innovation area this year. This is going to be an area for different companies to promote their ag technology or equipment during the event. It'll be a larger footprint area, which is going to flow right into the opening reception where people can network and get to know other people around these machines and equipment, and it should just make for a really fun end of the first day. And we're just looking for organic growers and producers who are looking to gain some knowledge about organic farming, some of the hot topics, and looking to meet with their supply chain and service providers.
It has been a good year for the California rice industry, but armyworm has been a constant issue for growers. President and CEO of the California Rice Commission, Tim Johnson, said the scope of armyworm challenges has been a relatively new issue for the industry.
You know, armyworm is a pest that really was not a factor when I started almost 30 years ago. Incidental note, maybe when an entomologist was presenting to the industry. Last 10 years, we've seen armyworm impacts that we hadn't really seen before. You add to that the fact that there's some resistance to pyrethroids, right? The common insecticide used to control armyworm. And we really needed to engage with the registrant community, engage with the regulators, and make sure that we had some tools available to growers to be able to treat armyworm. We're successful this last year getting Intrepid registered on rice.
The Biden-Harris administration is taking steps to safeguard the Colorado River system amid ongoing drought and climate impacts. The Department of the Interior's Bureau of Reclamation released a revised plan for the near-term operation of Glen Canyon and Hoover Dams until 2026. The initial draft proposed in April 2023 was temporarily withdrawn to consider a consensus-based proposal from the administration and individual states. The revised plan, open for public comment for 45 days, includes updates from the Lower Basin States proposal and improved hydrology data. Funding from President Biden's agenda supports measures to conserve 3 million acre-feet of water until 2026. While recent modeling reduces the risk of critical reservoir levels, the Colorado River Basin faces historically low levels requiring ongoing conservation efforts for water delivery and long-term sustainability. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more. I'm back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. One food item has in the past endured some poisonous press and a major legal battle, but is still a top U.S. food. Gary Crawford has more.
We are out here at good old Veg U at the Department of Agriculture's Farmers Market in Washington, D.C. We hopefully are going to get some veg-ucation. But instead of getting the lesson first and then give you the quiz, we're going to do it backwards. So it's quiz time. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Here's the quiz, Diz. What food item are we talking about? And here are the clues. One, for hundreds of years, people thought this food was deadly poison because it belonged to the nightshade family of plants. Clue two, Thomas Jefferson grew this food at his farm. And the last clue, the true identity of this food was the centerpiece of a legal case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. What food is it? Professors, the answer is...
Tomatoes!
Tomatoes, that's right. Of course, they ought to know they are our veducators today. Nikita Vivekanandan and Tomi Algerboy, both with the Ag Department's Marketing Service. Tomi, you were ready with another clue for the quiz. What was that?
Tomatoes are the most widely grown vegetable in the United States, but it's a fruit.
Not a vegetable?
They're technically a fruit.
But there may be some legal objections to that. Let's go back to the year 1883. Congress passes a tax on all vegetables that are coming into the U.S. from other countries. No tax on imported fruits. John Nix there is a food importer. He sues the Port of New York and its tax guy, Mr. Hedden, for all the tax that Nix has paid over the years on the tomatoes he had imported. Well, in this case, in 1893, it goes all the way to the Supreme Court. How did it come out?
The Supreme Court ruled that tomatoes were considered vegetables.
What? Hold on, that's Yes, Corporal!
Whoa, wow. That caused quite a stir. Who knows, maybe, though, they'll revisit that issue. But I guess it's good that the court ruled tomatoes as vegetables in one way. Otherwise, you guys, Tomi and Nikita, would be fruiticators. And this would be good old fruit you. That doesn't sound right, does it? No. Speaking of sounding, tomatoes have been caught up in another identity issue involving pronunciation. And you know the drill here.
You like tomato, and I like tomato. Tomato, tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
So you don't say tomato.
I personally don't, but to each their own.
Okay, all right. I'm going to call them what we used to call them down home, just maters, as in I'm going to pick me a mess of maters. So as far as picking maters, tomatoes, tomatoes, anyway, picking them at the store or at a farmer's market, Nikita, what is your advice for that?
You do want to have a tomato that is somewhat firm. If you're feeling any soft, squishy spots, it's probably a sign that the tomato is overripe and starting to go bad.
As to what to do with those tomatoes when you get them home, Nikita?
You do not want to put them in the fridge. If you do, they're going to lose their texture, their flavor, so you want to keep them at room temperature.
All right. Next time, we're going to take a look at the nutritional aspects of tomatoes and give you an idea for a little something different to do with tomatoes. Tomatoes. Majors. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
It's a fundraising effort for future ag leaders. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Tractor Supply Company kicked off the second annual FFA Future Leaders Scholarship Fundraising Drive. The Tractor Supply Foundation established the fund last year with a $5 million commitment over 5 years, making it the largest agriculture scholarship of its kind. In 2022, the inaugural fundraiser drive raised more than $1 million. The funds generated scholarships for 146 FFA students in 38 states, ranging from welding and electrical engineering to agricultural business, animal science, and others. Now through November 12th, customers can make a donation at checkout, either in TSC stores or online at tractorsupply.com. The goal is to raise another $1 million. The funds will generate $5,000 scholarships for students attending trade schools and two-year colleges to pursue a skilled trade or agriculture-related field. There will also be $10,000 scholarships for students pursuing agricultural-related four-year majors. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recently announced its U.S. forecast for this winter season, but how will that translate into weather conditions across the country? Here's Rod Bain.
Winter weather. It can at times feel like this.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful.
And occasionally, it has this kind of feel.
Cheeseburger in paradise.
Yet what will winter weather look like for the 2023-24 season? One indicator, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
The big story for the United States for the winter of 2023-24 is that we are looking at El Nino being in place for the first time in 5 years.
I'm Rod Bain. And coming up, a weather forecast for this coming winter season and what it could mean for agriculture and water supplies in this edition of Agriculture USA. El Nino. What does this climate pattern represent from a weather perspective? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey explains.
El Nino, in short, is a warming of the equatorial waters of the Pacific Ocean, mostly from the dateline eastward to the South American coast. And in that small sliver of ocean, there are profound impacts for not just U.S. climate, but global climate and weather patterns as well.
And according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, El Nino will be the predominant weather pattern for this coming winter.
There's typically two jet streams that affect the United States. There's a northern or a polar jet stream, and then there is a southern or subtropical jet stream. Typically during El Nino, we see a weakening of the northern jet stream, the polar jet stream, and a strengthening of the southern or subtropical jet stream.
As means to understand El Nino's potential impact weather-wise, Rippey discusses what happened the last time this climate pattern was the main winter weather catalyst, the winter of 2018-19. He starts with a near nationwide wet pattern going into the spring of 2019.
We dipped to a record low drought coverage, just over 2% of the country in drought in the spring of 2019. And we also saw extensive flooding in all three of the major river basins, the Mississippi, the Ohio, and the Missouri.
One difference between this coming winter and the winter of 5 years ago.
We have a lot more drought across the country heading into winter, so we're not quite expecting the same outcome in terms of the flooding and the wetness. But hopefully we can start chipping away at this expansive drought that currently covers roughly 40% of the lower 48 states as we head into the cold season.
So regarding temperatures for the winter of 2023-24,
a lot of the country tends to be quite mild, quite warm during El Nino winters. That is especially true across the northern half of the United States, extending all the way from parts of California and the Pacific Northwest through the northern plains, the Midwest, the Great Lakes states, and the Northeast. So we are expecting mild weather.
While in the nation's southern tier,
we tend to see more rainfall and cloudiness, so temperatures may cue a little bit closer to what we would expect to be normal for this time of year, but that really just means it'll be cloudy and rainy and not particularly cold.
El Nino in winter also leads to less than normal precipitation in much of the north and an active storm track through a southern stretch from California to the East Coast. So then, what could be potential impacts of El Nino on agriculture during the winter months? Brad Rippey starts with Western water supplies for irrigation, where water storage was boosted by last winter's significant precipitation accumulation. However,
some of the biggest reservoirs, especially those in the Colorado River Basin and in the Rio Grande, remain critically low following a generation of drought going back 20 to 25 years or more.
And El Nino could lead to drier than normal conditions in parts of the Pacific Northwest.
We'll have to keep an eye on the Columbia River Basin and some of the smaller waterways in the Northwest for potential signs of developing drought or intensifying drought.
El Nino also usually has favorable impacts on winter wheat. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has today's interview segment.
Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA, Robert Bonney, joins us here today to talk a little bit about some important new investments. And Undersecretary, we're talking to you this morning. You're actually out in Riverdale to highlight how these investments are being applied. And so let's start there with what these are and some of the goals with these investments.
Yeah, so we've gotten, you know, significant new resources for NRCS through the Inflation Reduction Act. So we have $19.5 billion in new resources, primarily targeted to our traditional conservation programs. And the president and the secretary announced earlier this week a $1.1 billion announcement of the Regional Conservation Partnership Program of projects across the country. 800 million of that is from the Inflation Reduction Act resources that are connected to climate mitigation. Obviously, livestock is really, really important. We're looking for ways that we can work through voluntary incentive-based approaches, partnerships, markets. And the project we're featuring today is part of that effort. We're at the Maddox Dairy. It's part of the California Dairies Inc. here, and they're looking at ways that they can use feed additives to reduce methane emissions from dairy cattle. U.S. dairy is already very efficient from a greenhouse gas standpoint, but there are lots of opportunities to do more and looking for ways that we can make it work for producers, for the environment at the same time is a critical part of the approach here, and so we're excited to. We've been talking to Steve Maddox out here and Darren as well, and we're excited to highlight this work today.
And now this recent investment, this is additional funding on top of what's already been there. So it sounds like there's quite a robust opportunity for significant improvements and further investment there.
That's exactly right, and it's going to ramp up in the coming years. And so Carlos and the other state cons are working with partners on the ground to develop projects that can produce greenhouse gas reductions and other, you know, important conservation benefits as well. So there are more opportunities here. And this is a project that'll be implemented at this dairy here, but other dairies as well. And we think there's a lot of opportunity to demonstrate that there's real demand in U.S. agriculture for here. If this is an incentive-based voluntary approach, farmers and ranchers are stepping forward in a big way. There's going to be lots more opportunities for them. And, you know, our hope here is that we can demonstrate more broadly the sustainability of U.S. agriculture, and that U.S. agriculture has an important role to play in reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
And kind of being a demonstration, this is a pilot. So the hope here is that something can be learned and maybe applied not just throughout California, but nationwide as part of this investment and look into some of these conservation practices.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the challenges on the livestock side has been enteric methane. And so the work here is to get at that, to look at the role of feed additives in reducing methane emissions. So there are real opportunities to reduce methane emissions. And importantly, if it doesn't pencil for the producer, it's not going to pencil for the environment. So doing this in a way that maintains agricultural productivity, that maintains economic viability, even as we promote sustainability, is critical.
And especially in the dairy sector, I know that the U.S. is a leader in dairy sustainability, but this seems like a project like this just allows for further refinement of some of those practices.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you're right. U.S. dairy has been a leader in this for a long, long time, and there's been a tremendous amount of innovation. What you see here is more of that. It's really a strong commitment to that innovation in the dairy sector. And, you know, there's increasing interest from consumers and others to look for ways that we can produce dairy more sustainably. This will help us with consumers in the U.S. It'll help us internationally as well. It'll create markets for U.S. dairy if we can demonstrate that we can, you know, continue to produce a quality product, but do it with being even more sustainable.
I'd like to drill down on just that aspect a little bit more of, you know, it's not just good for the environment and the sustainability piece, but this does offer an opportunity to become more attractive in some of the international markets.
I think that's right. I mean, we were just talking to Steve and Darren here, and they're talking about some of the interest they're getting from international markets around, you know, the sustainability characteristics of U.S. dairy products. And so, you know, we believe that a really important part of solving the climate challenge is going to be about technology and innovation, and U.S. agriculture and U.S. dairy in particular are really well positioned to take advantage of that.
Wonderful. Again, Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation at USDA, Robert Bonney, thank you for joining us here today.
Brian, great. Appreciate your time.
Thank you once again to Brian German and USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it's available on both Apple and Android devices. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agricultural news. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and now for more news. The Agriculture Secretary believes a new farm bill will not be approved by Congress before the end of the year. But what can be done to avoid a lapse in various USDA farm bill programs? Rod Bain reports.
With Congress still working to approve a new fiscal year budget before the latest continuing resolution ends on November 17th, what are the chances of a 2023 farm bill being approved and signed into law by the end of the year? In the opinion of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack,
we're not going to have a farm bill passed before December 31st.
Yet he also acknowledges an extension of the current farm bill is then needed.
Because we don't want the program to lapse, because if it were to lapse, there would be serious consequences to the farmers, but also very serious consequences to the economy and to consumers.
The secretary, speaking at this year's National FFA Convention, says the question then pertaining to an extension is its length of time.
I think the Senate leadership, in a bipartisan way, is suggesting a year. Don't know if the House has got that same timeline, but I think the House also recognizes they're not going to get it done before December 31st.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
USDA is boosting investments in export market promotion and international food aid. Gary Crawford has more.
With a farm bill that has expired with no clear path on that score and with still no federal budget set, the Agriculture Department's going to use $1.3 billion of last fiscal year's Commodity Credit Corporation funds to keep certain USDA international trade programs operating, specifically the Regional Agricultural Promotion Program. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters,
"We're looking to utilize these resources to continue to expand our efforts in terms of trade promotion in non-traditional markets. This will complement our existing trade promotion programs as we await Congress's action on both the budget and the farm bill."
Vilsack said the U.S. faces growing competition as it tries to sell its food and ag products around the world, and so it's essential to keep our export promotion programs going as much as possible.
It is clear to us that the key to trade opportunities involves making sure that we continue to support people in country who are representing and working for the United States and United States agriculture to promote our goods and products. It's important that we continue to have a presence in those key agricultural market areas. It's important for us to continue to do the trade missions, which we've done on an expanded basis in a number of traditional but also in a number of non-traditional market opportunities to continue the diversification effort. It's also critically important that we continue to provide resources for promotions, working with our cooperative groups across the world to make sure that customers and countries across the world are aware of the quality, the quantity, the safety, and the affordability of American agricultural exports.
Of course, some countries cannot afford to buy all the food they need. And so, in addition to the $1 billion investment in export promotion efforts to sell products,
we're also announcing an additional $1 billion that will be allocated for responding to the global food insecurity challenges we face across the world and providing resources for us to essentially make commodity donations.
This would involve USDA buying products from U.S. farmers and food companies to then be donated to help alleviate food insecurity for people around the world.
We think this will obviously also provide some additional boost to our own commodity markets and producers.
In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Foreign investment in U.S. agricultural land is a big topic. USDA's latest research, based on 2021 data, shows more than 40 million acres of American agricultural land are owned by foreign investors and companies. This corresponds to 3.1% of all privately held agricultural land and 1.8% of all land in the U.S. Canadian investors own the largest portion of foreign-held agricultural land with 31% or 12.8 million acres of the total and 0.97% of all U.S. agricultural land. Many of the current concerns center around China. According to the latest data, China is ranked 18th in ownership of U.S. agricultural land with 383,000 acres. That's less than 1% of total foreign-owned U.S. ag land and only 0.03% of all ag land in the U.S. It reflects a total area of about one-third the size of Rhode Island or that of an average county in Ohio. A University of Illinois FarmDoc report says China's soybean imports are likely to stay high through the fourth quarter this year, taking 2023 purchases to an all-time record. However, lackluster demand from hog farms is seen as reducing soybean purchases in early 2024. Traders and industry analysts say record Brazilian soybean supplies are expected to dominate China's imports in the last 3 months of this year, citing better oil and meal quality. That will reduce demand for U.S. cargoes in the world's biggest market for the oilseed. The larger share of Brazilian soybeans in China's import basket is likely to add pressure on benchmark Chicago futures, which slumped almost 15% this year, snapping a four-year rally. The report says, quote, "Typically, freshly harvested U.S. soybeans dominate the global export market after September as Brazil's export season winds down. But this year, China's purchases from the U.S. are well below normal." That's today's agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.